The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 9, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
So thank you for having me and for coming out. I just want to make a quick correction, especially for people who might be interested in that couples workshop, which is, I don't actually have a master's degree in couples counseling. My master's degree is in counseling psychology, though. And I have as Steve said, I've worked with couples doing pre-marriage counseling and marriage counseling, not as my main gig. My main gig is guiding teacher at Clouds and Water now. But anyway, I really love working with couples, so if you're interested... You can also email and ask me more questions about that. So this morning I wanted to speak from the Avatamsaka Sutra, and this is the whole sutra, so it's very dense, very big. I'm not obviously going to speak on the whole thing. But last year my project was to read the whole thing. And that started from, I started studying from this way. It was one of the first things I studied right after I was ordained, so in 1998. And then I didn't really take it up again until a couple of years ago. I was getting ready to teach Rohatsu Sesshin. And I thought, oh, why don't I look at teaching some things from the Avatamsaka Sutra, which I did. But sort of in the course of preparing for that, I just realized, wow, what a labor of love it was for the person who translated this. I mean, it's so dense and it's so, in some ways there's some repetition, but, you know, and there's just this far out language. And so that was my thought that arose. And then my next thought was, the least I can do is read it. And then right on the heels of that thought was a vow. In 2019, I will read it, and I did. So, it was quite an adventure. And now it's not like I'm setting it aside, right? So I'm still interested in it. But you can see there were many parts that I was especially interested in. So for those of you who aren't familiar, I just want to give you a little bit of background on this sutra. So. One English translation of it, Thomas Cleary, this translator's translation of the title is the Flower Ornament Scripture. It's also known as the Flower Garland Sutra. And it was written in India about 2,000 years ago, which was about 500 years after the death of the Buddha. And then translations from Sanskrit to Chinese began in about the year 420 of the Common Era. And then it was actually translated over a period of, I don't know, something like 300 years from the Sanskrit to Chinese. So another translation into the Chinese was around the year 700. And that's the translation from the Chinese that Thomas Cleary based his English translation on, and that was first published in 1984. So this sutra became very influential in Chinese Buddhism, and it spawned a school called the Huayan, or Flower Ornament School. So it was so influential that a whole school was named after the sutra. And its teachings deeply influenced Chan Buddhism, or Zen, which, you know, is Zen when it came to Japan. So in this sutra, there's many, like almost all the teachings of Buddhism are here. They're presented kind of in a little different way, but they're all here. So you find the paramitas, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. You find gatas. Do you use gatas here? So gatas are little like sayings or prayers or vows that you can do before doing certain activities, like washing my hands, I vow with all beings to attain the immaculate Dharma, forever undefiled. So like that's one example. It's just a way of bringing mindfulness into daily practices. So those are here. And there is detailed descriptions of abundance. That's the thing that's throughout this sutra, is this sense of abundance. So let me give you an example of that from the beginning. " And maybe a consumer warning on this. So some people really love this sutra because of this, you know, this sort of vast and fantastical description of reality. And other people are like, what does that have to do with my life? And so I would just invite you to, there's a few different ways you can listen to this. One way is to let yourself be inspired by the language of this generous, abundant description. And another way is to just see it as a metaphor. This is a metaphor for the abundance and the great truth that's available to us. So here's from, this is the very beginning of the sutra. Thus I have heard, at one time the Buddha was in the land of Magadha, in a state of purity, at the site of enlightenment, having just realized true awareness. The ground was solid and firm. So far that sounds pretty, you know, like realistic, but then it says, made of diamond, adorned with exquisite jeweled discs and myriad precious flowers with pure, clear crystals. The ocean of characteristics of the various colors appeared over an infinite extent. There were banners of precious stones constantly emitting shining light and producing beautiful sounds. Nets of myriad gems and garlands of exquisitely scented flowers hung all around. The finest jewels appeared spontaneously, raining inexhaustible qualities of gems and beautiful flowers all over the earth. There were rows of jeweled trees, their branches and foliage lustrous and luxuriant. By the Buddha's spiritual power, he caused all the adornments of this enlightenment site to be reflected therein. So, see how that lands with you. And if it's kind of landing with you like, you know, you notice kind of a shutting down, then I would invite you to just consider times in your life when maybe you've looked at something like a sunset or the dew on the grass in the morning right after sunrise and had this kind of, you know, like saw the diamonds there, right, with the dew and the sunlight reflecting, or saw the jeweled discs of dew on spider webs in the morning, you know, when it looks like a jeweled disc. So it could actually be this is a description of reality from when we have a very open and receptive mind to see things in this way. So what I think this is, these kinds of descriptions are encouraging us to open up beyond our usual understanding. So to me, this teaching is about the interpenetration of space and time. So like it has this description of this is what's happening when the Buddha was enlightened. So, you know, with a more, I don't want to say mundane, maybe just more conventional view, he's just a guy in ragged clothes sitting under a tree, and he wakes up to the truth. And then, in this sutra, it's saying, and at the same time, there's this other view, which is the jeweled trees and the, you know, all of this going on and the banners and all of this things going on. The other thing that happens in this sutra is often, it's like not necessarily right in that paragraph that I read, but many, many places it describes the Buddha's enlightenment site. And then it says, at the same time, this is going on, you know, in lands to the north and to the south and east and west and above and in universes that are far beyond and in hundreds of billions of universes. Like, it's happening. Usually we get sort of focused on what we can actually see, and that's good. I mean, we should be paying attention to what we can see and hear and perceive. But to me, the things in this sutra are kind of shaking that up a little bit by suggesting that we shouldn't be only so dependent on what we can perceive, because that's not all of reality. So this has been very, very helpful for me, you know, in that way. And I think this idea of Buddha's enlightenment happening in all places at once and in all times at once. There's a chant from the case of Shakyamuni Buddha that we do at Clouds and Water during Rohatsu Sesshin. One of the lines from it is, when Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened, so too were all beings on earth enlightened. Is that familiar to some of you? Yeah. And not only all beings on earth that were enlightened, all Buddhas of the past, present, and future also attained enlightenment. So like in that moment, all of this was happening. So to me, the flower ornament scripture is, you know, tells that story of that happening all at once, over and over. So I'll give you another little example of that, of how it tells that story. At that time, so the time of Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha, the world-honored one, in this setting, attained to supreme correct awareness of all things. His knowledge entered into all times with complete equanimity. His body filled all worlds. His voice universally accorded with all lands in the 10 directions. Like space, which contains all forms, he made no discrimination among all objects. And as space extends everywhere, he entered all lands with equanimity. His body forever sat omnipresent in all sites of enlightenment. Among the host of enlightening beings, his awesome light shone clearly like the sun emerging, illuminating the world. The ocean of myriad virtues which he practiced in all times was thoroughly pure, and he constantly demonstrated the production of all the Buddha lands, their boundless forms and spheres of light extending throughout the entire cosmos, equal and impartially. And let's see, it goes on, but okay, yeah, it goes on, and this is also, I think, helpful to give you a flavor of this sutra. He expounded all truths like spreading great clouds. Each of his hair tips was able to contain all worlds without interference. So, in each manifesting immeasurable spiritual powers, teaching and civilizing all sentient beings. So in each hair tip that was happening. His body extended through the 10 directions, yet without coming or going. His knowledge entered into all forms and realized the emptiness of things. All miraculous displays of the Buddhas of past, present, and future were all seen in his light, and all the adornments of inconceivable eons were revealed. And of course, there's a way in which you can hear this and think, oh, they're really like elevating the Buddha like a god. But we have to remember that it says, when Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened, so too were all beings on earth enlightened. So in fact, that is representative of all of us as well. Again, like you can take it as a metaphor, or you can take it as a, oh, there's a way of understanding reality that's beyond my usual way of looking at things. So since I can't talk about the whole book, I just picked one section that I'd like to talk about today, which is the stage of extreme joy. And this sutra is divided into 39 books, and in book 26, it outlines the 10 stages of enlightenment. And then the first stage is the stage of extreme joy. So let me read a little something from the opening of that book 26 on the 10 stages. Or actually, I'm just going to read one sentence from my notes. So the book opens with this. This is the setting. Not long after his perfect enlightenment, the second week. So to me, it's just hilarious that it's going to go into this, you know, this description, and then it really specifically says the second week. Not long after his perfect enlightenment, the second week, he was in the palace of the king of the heaven of control of others' emanations. A shining, radiantly pure treasury of jewels, together with a large group of enlightening beings. So that's the setting. So it says, well, we think that he just, you know, like sort of talked to the few disciples and, you know, went on the rounds in India. But here it says, well, actually, at the same time, he was, a couple weeks after his enlightenment, he was in this heaven of the control of others' emanation with this shining radiance all around. And then it talks about how the enlightening beings there that were practicing there, and this is important, we're entering into both mundane existence and nirvana. So I think that's kind of the whole teaching of the sutra, is it's giving us the nirvana side. But then every once in a while it throws in something like the second week. So it's reminding us, well, actually this is grounded in something that really happened. So then practicing both mundane existence and nirvana. So how do you do both is the question. You know, that might seem pretty challenging. So to me, doing both is being completely present with an open heart mind. That's how we can do both. Practicing presence, practicing concentration, zazen, practicing openness, and body awareness. So we start like with that mundane existence, but with an openness. And then that's how we can practice mundane existence and nirvana at once. So here we are in this setting, this Buddha in this shining heaven with these bodhisattvas who are practicing entering into mundane existence and nirvana. And then sort of in this mix, then we have the foremost of these enlightening beings. And by the way, if you ever look at this sutra, to me, a great teaching is just the names of some of the enlightening beings. Just the names themselves are really inspiring. Today I won't, unless we have time at the end, I won't read a section of the names. I've done that before, but some people are blown away and other people shut down, so it's again like that. But there's this one, it says the foremost of the enlightening beings' name was Diamond Matrix. So I will read something that Diamond Matrix says. So at that time, Diamond Matrix, by the power of Buddha, entered the concentration called Light of the Great Vehicle. Great Vehicle being, of course, Mahayana Buddhism, which includes everyone. So Diamond Matrix entered the concentration called Light of the Great Vehicle, and as soon as he had done so, there appeared to him as many Buddhas as atoms in the 10 billion Buddha lands, from beyond as many worlds as atoms in the 10 billion Buddha lands, in each of the 10 directions. And here's the kicker, all of whom were alike named Diamond Matrix. So to me, it's like imagining, so if I'm that bodhisattva, Diamond Matrix, we can all be bodhisattvas. So we enter into a concentration, we're sitting zazen, and then suddenly from all the directions, all these numerous directions, all these Buddhas appeared, and they all have our name. So that to me, like right there, is a teaching on letting go of the self. I mean, where is the self? And also, it's so uplifting. Like, oh, it's sort of confirming, like, we can do this practice. It's encouraging that this would happen. So the billions of Buddhas named Diamond Matrix all praised the Bodhisattva Diamond Matrix, and they pat his head. Which is also, oh, well done. And then Diamond Matrix speaks about his vast vow to free all beings, but then says he's reluctant to put it into words because he's afraid, like, people will shut down. People won't, you know, they won't really understand. They won't want to receive it. So with that, let's see. I want to say what he says about that. He says, his Diamond Matrix speaking to the assembly, difficult, supreme is this, rare, the revelation of enlightening beings' practice. Supreme is the discernment of the practice of the stages whence Buddhahood is attained. Subtle, hard to see, beyond thought, beyond the ground of mind, hard to approach. It is the realm of the wise with untainted minds, hearing which confuses the worldly. Oh, hearing which confuses the worldly. So he's worried it will confuse people if he tries to say something. Keeping the mind as stable as diamond, believe in the supremacy of Buddha knowledge. Knowing the mind ground is selfless, then one can hear this subtle knowledge. Like colors painted in the sky, like the wind in space, so is this undefiled knowledge of Buddha hard to see, though it be defined. Such is my understanding of that. It's hard to find anyone in the world who knows it or even believes in it. Thus, I cannot explain this ultimate. So it's like, sorry, I'm not going to say anything. But then, luckily for us, there's another bodhisattva in the assembly called Moon of Liberation, and he begs Diamond Matrix to please say something. And so then Diamond Matrix relents and says, okay, here's the 10 stages of enlightenment. And I'm like I said, I'm just going to talk about one, but I'll just name the 10 in case you're interested in hearing them. So the one is extreme joy. Two is purity, or practice of the precepts. Three is refulgence, or a state of brilliance, shining, focused mind, extra-dimensional powers, so that's included in refulgence. Four is blazing radiance, reflecting the radiance of the Buddha's teachings. Five is difficult to conquer, and in this stage there's a vast, wide-open mind and precise, particular, upright activities. But actually, we find that in a lot of the other stages, but in that stage it's especially emphasized. Six is presence of unattached knowledge. Seven is going far. Eight is immovability. Nine is good mind. And 10 is cloud of teaching. So that doesn't sound like something you could do step by step to attain enlightenment. Hearing these stages, but this is just like just sort of describing a reality of what it can be like, which is not something that's not explainable. As Diamond Matrix says, I don't want to say it because it really can't be spoke, but then when he does speak something, it sounds like these stages. So in this sutra, the last book, book 39, is a story of the pilgrim Sudana's journey, and through that story, the entire teaching of the first 38 books is summarized and unfolded. So in book 39, Sudana meets with 53 teachers, and they each share a particular teaching. So what I thought I would do is share the teaching from the teacher Vasanti, who is teaching about the stage of extreme joy. So I'm kind of skipping ahead to the last book, but it's going to reflect back on book 26, which is talking about the stages and particularly the stage of extreme joy. So it's interesting to me that the 10 stages, so there's all kinds of different teachers that Sudana meets with. You know, some of them are sort of what you think of as regular teachers. You know, they're Zen masters, maybe we could say. They're priests, they're wearing robes, you know, and others are just like householders and, you know, beggars and potters and, you know, they're doing different things and prostitutes and, you know, there's all different, and some are old and some are children, so there's all different teachers that he learns from. The 10 stages are all explained, or he learns of the 10 stages from teachers called night goddesses, so there's whatever that means. Again, it's like this is a vision of reality that's not our conventional view. But to me, what the night goddess Vasanti teaches is so wonderful that I don't care if she really existed or not. You know, it's like helpful. So I'd like to talk about the stage of extreme joy as taught by Vasanti. So she's a very interesting character. She's described vividly. Things like she's sitting in a tower of jewels, which it says refer to enlightening teachings, that she's on a lion throne, which symbolizes stability and majesty, that the throne is in the center of a lotus flower, which symbolizes unfolding knowledge, and also like coming from the mud. It said her body is adorned with ornaments. So the flower ornament scripture is referring to like ornaments that are on the, one might wear on the body or decorate a house. So it says the ornaments refer to virtues. And she's wearing a red robe, which symbolizes birth and death and also passion. Not like a clinging kind of passion, but more like passionate zeal for practice. And then it says her body showed reflections of the moon, stars, and constellations, which it says means that the stage of extreme joy, we should remember it includes everything. So like she's teaching extreme joy, and so in her body is reflected the moon and stars and constellations, so like the whole universe. And then I just want to read what they say is in her pores. Or this is what Sudhana saw. He saw in her pores all the sentient beings who had been liberated by her from the calamities of unfavorable circumstances, evils, and miserable conditions. He also saw in her pores all the sentient beings whom she had settled in heaven. He also saw in her pores all the various means, embodiments, and appearances she assumed to perfect them, to perfect the sentient beings. He also heard coming from her pores the various utterances she used to teach and develop them. He also perceived in her pores the timing, the adaptation to sentient beings' inclinations and interests, the enlightening practices, forceful means, ways of mystic transformation through concentration, powers, states of observations, contemplations, mystic projections, powerful expansions of the great person, and free mastery of liberation by which they were perfected. So again, it's like this fantastical vision of what is the teaching of extreme joy. And it's giving us a hint, like what it is she's helping people. So, what does she do then? Because really the teaching is not just what she looks like. It's what she does. So here's what she does. And this is just, I'm not going to even read everything, but I'll just read some sections of what she does. Any people who travel on a dark night where ghosts, thieves, and thugs lurk, when the sky is covered with black clouds, when it is misty, windy, and raining, when there's no moonlight or starlight, when there's no visibility, if they go on the sea or the land or in the mountains, over deserts or through forests, through provinces or villages or on roads, if they are shipwrecked at sea or held up on land or fall in the mountains or run out of provisions in the desert, if they get stuck in the underbrush, in the forest, or run into trouble, or if they get scattered in darkness, or if they get mugged in a town, or if they get lost or confused and cannot tell the direction they are going in, or if they run into disaster on the road, I rescue them by various means. Through various forms of being, I act as a support and a reliance. This root of goodness, furthermore, I dedicate in this way. May I be a refuge for all sentient beings to put an end to all suffering. So that's her bodhisattva vow. But she doesn't just say that. She says, like, specifically, here's what I could do. And here's what I do. And then it goes on. For those on precipitous mountain paths in danger of death, so they may live. For those who are dominated by the desire for fame, those who wish for renown, those who seek enjoyment, those who are avaricious, who strive to get material things, those whose foremost desire is worldly success, those who are wrapped up in affection for their families, who are lost in the jungle of views, who are oppressed by various miseries and fear, I become a refuge by various means. For example, producing caves in mountains for shelter, producing fruits and roots for food, producing streams for drinking water, producing shelter against the cold and heat, by showing the right path for those who are lost, by the songs of birds. Wow, that must be for those who want enjoyment. So then she gives the sounds of birds. By the luster of medicinal plants, by the glow of mountain spirits, I become a refuge for those in mountain caves and crevices, those oppressed by various pains, dispelling the darkness, producing level ground for them. So I recently, about a month ago, broke my ankle, so I can, and I'm recovering from that now, and I can appreciate producing level ground. Because when I had a broken ankle, any kind of incline or up steps became difficult. So this, I can see why that's helpful. And then she says, and I resolve that just as I rescue these people in the mountains, so too will I become a refuge for those fallen on the precipitous trails of the mountain of mundane existence. So if she's using it like, okay, it's an actual thing, like if those are people are actually lost in the mountains, I'm going to do this. But also people who are falling on the precipitous trails of mundane existence. So in other words, just sort of ordinary everyday suffering or ennui. She'll also help them. Is there a clock somewhere? Just. Oh, thank you. I just want to make sure that I'm not going on too long. So anyway, I could read more because there's wonderful examples, but maybe I'll just say, in the stage of extreme joy, the activity, one of the foremost activities is removing fears. So it's giving, there's a joy of giving, helping, but specifically removing fears. And I think, you know, hearing stories like this or descriptions like this, there's at least two ways to think of it. So one is like, may I be that bodhisattva who helps others so deeply in this way. But the other way is, maybe you read it and you think, oh, I actually feel like I'm traveling on a dark night on precipitous mountain paths. I'm struggling and I am afraid and in need of rescue. So then, if that's true, then you can receive it. Then you can, that can be a bodhisattva activity. So it's a bodhisattva activity if you receive that help, not as kind of a release valve, so that then you don't have to think about things anymore, but really as a way to be able to look deeply and see the root cause of your fears and suffering. And there's a question here of how do fears leave? And it said, in the stage of extreme joy, the concept of a separate self is gone. So there's no clinging to a self or material things, and therefore no fear of not surviving. No fear of ill repute, no fear of dying, no fear of states of misery, no fear of intimidation. So I'll say more about that in a moment. But I'll just say, to emphasize again, this great enlightening being Vasanti, who's embodying the stage of extreme joy, she helps beings with these specific tangible remedies, like finding them shelter from the cold if they're lost in a dark night. And she also commits to ending the root of suffering. So sometimes, I think as Buddhists, we want to just go to entering the root of suffering, and we might forget that, oh, that the beings need some actual real help. And other times what can happen is we can get caught up in offering the real help, which is good, but then if we lose sight of also ending the root of suffering, then we can get so discouraged and burnt out. So Vasanti, because she's embodying extreme joy, she does both. So let's see, I want to read a few more sections. Okay. This kind of touches on how she does both, I think. As for those in inhabited areas, like that's most of us, we're not living alone in the mountains. For those in inhabited areas who are experiencing the trouble of owning a home, I just love that. I draw them away from their attachments to their abodes by various means, and resolve by this root of goodness to remove all sentient beings from attachment to the elements of body and mind and establish them in the wisdom that does not rely on anything. As for those in villages who are attached to their house and relatives, beset by various family troubles, their minds agitated by various anxieties, I take care of them by material gifts and please them in a proper manner, establish them in the state of non-attachment, and resolve by this root of goodness to remove those who cling to the village of their senses from the sphere of mundane objects and set them in the sphere of omniscience. So as a guiding teacher, at Clouds and Water, I talk to a lot of people who are beset by various family troubles. And I don't tell them, oh, you know, you should just think of supreme enlightenment and realize that this is really not a problem because we're all connected and really everything is fine. It's like, no. It's like, how can you meet these family troubles that are happening? And then, if there's an opportunity, I might suggest, is there a way that you can look deeply at the root of the suffering of this? Doesn't mean you ignore your family. Doesn't mean you turn away from them, although sometimes people need to do that. That might be, you know, a skillful means, depending on the situation. But first, to provide, you know, some help, you know, as much as I'm able, and then how can we look deeply at the root? So that's what we all can do in our own lives. I mean, I try to do that for myself as well when I'm beset by family troubles. And we can do that for ourselves and we can do that for our friends. But it might mean that we don't even say anything about interdependence and enlightenment. And maybe we don't say anything at all, but we just help them. But we do it from our, as much as possible, non-attached attitude. And then that can help them also maybe to see deeply into the roots of their suffering. And helping others in this way is extreme joy when it's practiced with a view of no separate self. Even like a little bit toward a view of no separate self, you can start to open to that joy. So really, when you think about it, it can be, you know, sort of pretty specific. Like if you're thirsty and you give yourself a drink of water, which reminds me, I should take a drink of water. Excuse me. That was kind of good timing, but I really also needed that. So if you're very thirsty, I wasn't very thirsty, I was just a little bit, but if you were very thirsty and then you give yourself a drink of water, isn't that extreme joy? I mean, can you think of situations where you've been really deprived and then you had something that was really needed and nourishing and then it's like, oh, it's just extreme joy. So in the same way, if you're not separate from others, when you act to relieve their suffering, it's like that. So it's extreme joy. So of course, when you hear a teaching like that, sometimes this inner critic voice comes up, like, I'm very far from that. I don't see myself as not separate from others. How can I possibly practice? Right? So if some thought like that is arising for you, I would just say, actually, it's no problem. So you can actually just receive the glass of water from the Vasantis in your life. So you can receive help. You can, you know, because a lot of times people say, well, I'm just really suffering. How can I help others and their suffering? I'm really caught in my own suffering. And it's like, well, then your task is to actually relieve that suffering. Because if it's true that you're not separate, then when you act to relieve your own suffering or receive help from someone else, then it's actually relieving the suffering of all beings because you're not separate. So even if you don't believe that, like provisionally you could say, okay, well, let me go forward like this. Because really, if you go forward as a suffering being just trying to relieve others' suffering without resolving the root of suffering, then doesn't really usually work so well, you know, because you can be resentful, you can easily burn out, and you're not giving with joy. So joy isn't arising in that case. So what to do to approach this, you know, so if you, obviously just receiving help can be one step of the path, but maybe you say, yeah, but I would really like to have this view of not having a separate self. So you probably know this already, but I'll just say, the step is to continue to study the self in order to see that the view of a separate self causes suffering. So like you just continue to look at what's happening. And by study, I don't mean read a book. Well, you could read a book, like you could read this book, you could read some book that's helpful, but then you start to look at your internal process. Like what is going on that I'm creating this view of a separate self and how it's causing suffering. So you can see that. Look deeply is also doing zazen, sitting and being still. It's doing mindfulness practice as you go throughout your day. It's looking deeply at your own body and mind and emotions. And maybe asking the question, where does the self end and other people and objects begin? Like where is the line of separation? And, you know, you can look at that in your daily life in a, you know, even sort of a scientific way. Like, okay, I'm breathing in air. It's out there. Now it's in here. Well, so it wasn't me and now it is. And now I'm breathing out. You know, I'm exhaling. And so it was me and now it's out. And like, so where really is the separation? Or eating food? Or where your sense of your body is? So, you know, and sometimes people can come kind of close, and even if they're behind you and they're not touching you, you sort of know they're there. So they're not touching your skin. So is the body extending out, and how far out? And so you can like look at that. That can be an interesting course of study, just to see where does this self, this so-called self, and others begin. And sometimes I think when you start to look like that, you see or experience that sense of a separate self to dissolve. And when you do that, you may be able to receive the more extreme teachings from Vasanti. And actually, it's one of the first things that she said, but I didn't read it first because I thought, okay, then people will just really like, oh no, that's impossible. So here is what she says. I am kind to the evil-minded, compassionate to evildoers. So that seems a bit extreme. And I would just also like to add that being kind to evildoers, it's not being kind to evildoers at the expense of their victims, but it's including everyone. So being kind to evildoers at the expense of their victims is the way that things like white supremacy, patriarchy, and all kinds of oppression continue if we just be kind to evildoers at the expense of their victims. So we need to have the whole picture. But there is this radical compassion of not separating even from those that we think are evil-minded or doing harm, that we're not separating ourselves from them. And that's the kind of radical compassion that Vasanti is talking about. It is compassion that sees down to the root of suffering. So we can even see like, oh, this person who's causing so much harm is really suffering. And they might not even know the depth of their suffering because they've found a way to cover it up so that they can just go on. But we can be kind to them. So being kind, and what does being kind mean? I mean, sometimes being kind or compassion might mean speaking out against the evil. So it doesn't just mean that it's really okay. You know, sometimes it's like taking a strong stance and speaking out. And it might mean that someone's career is ruined or their reputation is damaged because you've stood up for yourself and for those who were oppressed. So sometimes that's what being kind looks like. So it might mean that you end an abusive marriage or give truthful testimony that sends someone to jail, or just that you yell stop. That might be being kind. So if you're doing that from the place of not a sense of separation. And remember, just to say, in case you think I'm making up the thing about, you know, that this is what kindness is, it says one of the enlightening practices that Sudhana saw in Vasanti's pores was called forceful means. Forceful means. So sometimes it looks like that. So a caution, too, is that so there might be a tendency to want to cut off the evildoers as separate, because then we can feel better about ourselves, like, well, I'm not like that, I'm not that, that's evil. If we do that, we actually set up a dynamic for the continuous arising of evil. So we're not really looking at the root. So that's a caution, and that's also an encouragement to, again, like how is the practice of no separate self manifesting, and what does that mean? So from my Christian background, which I was raised Catholic, so I practiced that for many years, and I remember that one of the root meaning of the word sin, you know, which is like the evil, is separation. So, and in that, you know, world, it's maybe separation from God, but I think it can be distilled down to separation. Like when we separate, that is one of the things that's really the root of evil. It's othering, it's that view of a separate self that then, you know, perpetrates the continuing of evil, even if we think we're on the side of good. So that's kind of a warning for us. And that view of separate self is really deeply ingrained, so we need to unlearn it. And we unlearn it, again, through meditation, through getting in touch with our bodies, deeply experiencing our world with an openness that lets us open to maybe what I actually see and experience isn't all that's there. But not turning away from what I see and experience, actually turning toward it. You know, turn the light to shine within. Look deeply at ourselves. And then we can't do that through our mind alone, so we can't think our way through this. And you also can't learn it by yourself alone, and that's why we have sanghas. And that's why we have teachers and communities. So when we talk about taking refuge, we don't just take refuge in the Dharma, the teaching. We also take refuge in the Buddha, the teachers, and the Sangha, community of excellent friends. So I'm just going to kind of skip ahead a little here. So in my experience, when one lets go of the notion of a separate self, then extreme joy naturally arises. Like to me, that's what naturally arises. And it's not a false joy that may be used to deaden or sedate. So sometimes people are suspicious when they hear about joy. So that false joy would be like a joy I try to keep for myself alone, or maybe just share with a few people that I like a lot. But this extreme joy is the great vows arise to honor the Buddhas, to teach and save all beings, to completely awakening. And then engaging those vows increases the joy. So the separate self can start to dissolve. A sense of extreme joy arises, and then with that, there's a vow to continue. And it's actually said the foremost practice of the bodhisattva in this stage, the stage of extreme joy, is dana paramita, or the transformation of giving. And sometimes the stage is even called giving joy. So I wanted to leave at least a few minutes for people to ask questions, so I think I'll stop there. And just also say thank you very much for listening and for coming out. And it always makes me happy to talk from the flower ornament scripture. So to have a new audience, it's nice. So thank you so much. Are there questions or comments? Yeah.
Yes, I'd like to know what your thoughts are, whatever, on rather compassion and despair, such as over 200 species of animals and so forth are dying every day.
Uh-huh.
You know, when these are gone, we're going to be extinct too. Yeah. Things of that nature, you know, seeing that probable mass extinctions really looks like going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, medical stuff that's going on, that there's increases in all the, these diseases and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I experienced a fair amount of despair about that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, like, how do we balance that in a, you know, as a practicing Zen
right.
person?
That's a
and
good question.
And like, okay, this is what's going on. And most people are just kind of walking around like, it's going to be like, it's going to keep continuing like always.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Yeah. So I have a few thoughts that come up. So radical compassion is compassion for the whole works. So that is, you know, if you can do something to assist, like the bees, then doing it. So like going forward with what I can do. But then also, it's having compassion for those people that you say are like walking around like nothing is, you know, like there's nothing to worry about. Having compassion for those people as well. And if you have compassion for them and aren't trying to change them or judging them, then it's actually, there's more of a chance that when you interact with them, they might listen to your view. So there is that kind of way. And then for me, the other big balancing of that project is remembering impermanence. So when I remember that, you know, actually eventually this is all going to end. I mean, not just like my life, but, you know, eventually, even if we avert this environmental disaster, eventually the sun's going to burn out or explode or whatever's supposed to happen to the sun. You know, eventually it's all going to end. You know, human beings aren't going to last forever. The earth isn't going to last forever. And I don't engage that thought as a way of despair, but just rather as a way of saying everything is changing and dying and being born, and that's how it is. So I have that view, but I don't like fall so far onto that view that then I say, well, then what's the point of saving the bees? Because there is a point of saving the bees. There is a point of having compassion for the beings that are existing right now. But then if I balance it out against this compassion for all the beings and a remembering impermanence, then I can keep going and not be in despair. And again, it's like that's a sort of intellectual way of talking about it, but you probably need to just do more sitting and, you know, opening to be able to receive that teaching in a way where it really comes into your body and mind. And, you know, maybe you've had glimpses of that, and so then you can say, oh, yeah, I remember that time when I sat and it really felt like everything was all right. And that is a basis, and that's true. And it's also true that the bees are dying and all these animals are becoming extinct, and then we can do something. But from this heart of love and not wanting to make things different than they are, not clinging to the idea that things should be different than they are, and still working toward a better world. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps a lot. It gets a little more personal when it's the death of me.
Yeah, right. But that might be a good one to contemplate then.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. Yeah, I think about that a lot, actually, the death of me. Not just, probably more now that I turned 60 than I did earlier, but I've been thinking about it for a while. And it's a really, really helpful way to engage impermanence. Yeah, thank you for your question. Yes?
When you were starting out talking about the Garland Flower Sutra, I was reminded of something I heard on the radio yesterday, on the Moth Radio Hour. A woman, when she was a teenager, had entered into this reality TV show, and it was called Boys Against the Girls in Puerto Rico. So there were four boys and four girls, and they went to this small island four miles across in Puerto Rico. And on the island was a bay, and it was surrounded by mangroves. And the connection to the ocean was very shallow, wasn't it? So waves didn't come in very much. And this made this bay one of the most prolific places for the small single-cell organisms that do luminescence in the water to be able to really live well there. And so they went out on a boat at night. And it was just incredibly joyful because they were glowing. And they were swimming and the trails of the water was, you know, and their fingers were glowing. It was just made me think of that.
Yeah, so things like that actually do exist in real life. That we can actually see. Yeah, thank you. But I think one of the things that flower ornament scripture is also saying is that it's like that all the time too.
Yes.
You know, we're actually glowing, but we don't see it. Anyone else? Well, maybe that's enough for today then. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.